This evening, Darlene Cohen is speaking on Ill Will in the Abhidhamma on September 8, 2003 in Sacramento.
So, tonight I'd like to discuss from the Abhidharmic point of view and from the middle way point of view, anger and ill will. And as I said last time, the Abhidharma is a first century BC document, the first compendium of which we're aware of how to practice, a cookbook for enlightenment. And because it way predates the middle way and the rise of Mahayana Buddhism, it has a very different point of view toward the emotions, their role, and bringing them under control. So, tonight we'll discuss anger from both the Abhidharmic, first the Abhidharmic, and then the middle way point of view. And I think this is instructive, at least according to what we talked about last time. The feedback I got about last time is that it actually helps a lot to understand the middle way if you present a different point of view first. We discussed lust and desire last time. So, Buddhism has a really different way of thinking about anger and ill will and the wrong visited upon you than just the way you tend to think of anger, ill will, and injustice. And there are no obstacles as potent as the obstacle of anger and ill will as far as happiness. It's the biggest obstacle to happiness, and it's also very difficult to begin practice if ill will is your particular thing. You know, greed, hate, and delusion, this is the hate part of it. It's much harder to practice if you're a hate type than if you're a greed or a delusion type. Because if you're a greed type, just, ooh, I want that practice, I want that enlightenment. So, that's great. All you have to do if you're a greed type is shift your focus at some point. And if you're a delusion type, then it's, what's happening? You don't have to do anything else. Then a friend takes you to a Dharma talk and you say, okay, I'll do this. Everybody else is doing it. So that's good. That's good. So all you have to do as a delusion type is kind of focus on what's in front of you. Much easier than shifting this huge antipathy and hatred toward anything and everything and, you know, criticism. You know, you come to a Dharma talk or you come to say, ridiculous. You know, the Japanese must have made this up as revenge for World War II. And then to, no matter what is being said, you come up with arguments to counter what is being said. So it's very difficult to move this aside, this huge habit and karma aside, and begin to be open to things. And this is how ill will and anger, I'll just talk about ill will, and we'll get to anger as a special topic, a special subset of ill will. So this is how ill will functions as an obstacle to happiness, because everything that happiness consists of, an open heart, compassion, flexibility, generosity, relaxation, gratitude, ill will destroys. Ill will gives you an attitude that's the opposite of what makes you happy. So, it's worthwhile talking about it. And the Abhidharma is very direct, very clear, gotta get rid of it. And I'll tell you, the ancient, our time and most, the venerable, that's the word I want, the venerable methods that have been developed over the centuries to deal with ill will if you're trying to get rid of it. The middle way, on the other hand, is trying to harness the energy and make it, you know, some kind of fuel. So we'll get into that. So can anybody tell me, can I just hear some suggestions of what's difficult, given what I've said? What are specific difficulties with ill will and in everyday situations. What's difficult about it? To just bear out what I said, yeah. This is very much true of hot anger as opposed to just kind of smoldering ill will. Yeah, hot anger is right, very addictive. Very hard to break that pattern. And so then how does it manifest as an obstacle to happiness in daily life? So, what you were just saying about being a victim or being self-righteous, that's very separating of you from other people. So often people with a stance of ill will or a habit of ill will would rather be right than happy. That's right. A person with a stance of ill will would have a lot of difficulty seeing that whatever is gained by the other side is not necessarily lost by my side, if I've got the stance of ill will. Because it's kind of a very, you know, starvation kind of point of view, where there's just so many resources and only one person can have them, that kind of thing. Anything else? So this again is a reward. I mean, you actually feel better because you're superior. You can go around and say, you know, your judgment is constantly being violated in an unpleasant way. And this feels good as long as you don't mind being alone. So eventually, you have to decide whether you'd rather be connected to other people or, again, be right. Be right. I always think of as a ready example for this kind of thing that Philippa mentioned is a food critic that can't go to his friend's house for dinner. Always has to be in the stance of criticizing, judging, finding it wanting. And here he's completely overlooking the friend cooking the dinner. You know, the heart, the offering, overlooking the offering because this could have been cooked better, this blah blah. So as a stance, ill will is really the pit. It's really hard to mental practice with that stance, but not impossible. Like, in fact, of all the fetters of greed, hate, and delusion, perhaps, the ill will fetter is the most, seems to me, that it's most urgent to release that fetter. Now, when I say ill will is a stance, it doesn't mean you can never have ill will and never, you know, have anger or anything like that. I mean, ill will is a stance, just as the Abhidharma called it, antipathy. And they characterize it as sullenness, envy, stinginess, I'm not getting enough, the rest of the world doesn't deserve it anyway. Constantly focusing on what offends, what is distasteful, what is contrary to one's principles. In other words, the unpleasant side of life. Often when people get older and they've had this stance, they have many regrets because they're unable to be content. In fact, I've met people who have an actual distrust of contentment, afraid that if they put aside their ill will and get content for even an hour or a day, then, oh my God, who's going to judge stuff? Who's going to, the world will get all messy. The result is hatred, malevolence, and jealousy, a state of slavery to your thoughts. Because when you make judgments, those are pretty hard thoughts. I mean, hard in the terms that you usually think they're right. So it's very difficult to let go of judgments, especially if they're based on like good taste. I had a friend once, and I thought she had terrible taste in art. In fact, she was a craft fair person, and she made these, you know, things that you wouldn't buy, right? And she used to give them to me, and I thought, okay, what are you going to look at? The thing or the offering? So I started having them all over the house. And do you know that I was able to shift into every time I saw those things, I thought, love, it's love. Wow, at first I had to say that, and then it would just happen. So that, and what is that? That's a judgment of what is low or high class in our case. I mean, how arbitrary or unreal or empty can you get? What is good taste in art? I mean, that is so arbitrary. So what I've just been describing from the Abhidharma is the ill will of the precepts. What is it, the eighth precept? Don't harbor ill will. And I think of ill will as cold rage, ongoing resentment, a failure to forgive. It poisons the body and the atmosphere around. You know, when a person's in a snit, you know, you just don't go near that person, right? Because the whole air is vibrating with some kind of undischarged anger. So this is also the kind of anger that has biochemical consequences and physical consequences for people who harbor this. People get sick and break down after a while. Because if you carry this kind of feeling around, your organs are in a state of contraction. You know, I remember acupuncture points, there are certain organs that are affected by, you know, feelings of anger. So that's different from hot anger, which was mentioned, which is much more malleable, much more useful, much more, you can change it into good and or bad energy. You can use it in a way. Hot anger, explosive, molten, and it's kind of pure until it's expressed. I mean, it just moves through the body, you know, you can feel that adrenaline going, the heart beats faster. It's just pure until it's expressed in one direction or another. And as we've already mentioned, righteous anger fuels social action. That's a good kind of anger. I won't put up with this. This is unjust. It's enough to make me do something. That's good anger. But when it gets self-referential, disintegrates into or degenerates into self-righteousness. Once again, your opinion is the correct one. Nobody else knows. Then you get a lot of antagonism. You get, you know, people having fights on the edge of peace marches and things like that. So that self-righteousness actually hinders effectiveness in politics. And this is what Rita Gross's article is about. If we don't get to it, please read it on your own. She's a feminist, and she just gives a wonderful synopsis of her evolution from being, you know, a combative feminist and then start practicing, and then, you know, how she now talks to people who don't have the same point of view as she does. So this is one of the biggest problems in idealistic groups like this one. You know, how does the Buddha get angry? So any comments on what you had to deal with in political or religious groups? Well, that's great. I mean, that's a real life situation. You can feel justified around that.
Yeah.
And so then how does one deal with this poison? Recognizing it as a poison. Anything, any other situations in groups or in Iron Bell or FBMD?
Well, I had an opportunity to spend a Labor Day weekend with my brother, and he and I were raised in the same house of ill will. And it was really interesting because I see in him, it was more present than me as far as I decided, but it was still present in me, but I see it just helped me see that mindset that we inherited that is goes after people. And that really does keep, you know, people separated in their own spirit. And I was kind of trying to, you know, work with my brother a little bit on the gist of what he was becoming God in training. And because of the kind of invective that he was feeling from the world and situations that he was in, it was just very apparent.
Yes, I think it's heroic when people even cry. I'm not kidding. I think that is just huge when people cry to bring up a new way or a new response, a new reaction to what they've always done, The odds against it are phenomenal. The odds against it are phenomenal. So if you actually succeed in even once producing a different response to the same old situation, and everybody in the world, because It shows what the human potential is. It makes the human potential manifest. So if you can do it once, even once, and then if you do it a couple of times, then if you actually change the way you look at things, that is what's so unlikely to happen. You actually expand human potential. So each one of you has this charge. So this is not easy stuff. The generations, who knows how many, since the first hare crawled out of the lake onto the land. And look what you're doing. So, any other situations? Yes.
Yeah, but everything I go on the river all the time. Maybe first in an hour later, just chat, have a great time enjoying the sun, and then I walk back to shore. And within an hour, I'll go to probably 200 feet down the river. And those three guys are starting to mess it. Well, now, trying to get girls a mud wrestle. They got to the top. The drinking and smoking, and right next to a family that's tired, has come up for rest, and saying, oh, come on, BS, and there's these little kids there, and the transformation of me and them sitting and talking, they were like completely different people, and I did feel an anger there, what's going on here, and the river didn't matter, didn't even exist for the people, for the people.
So you had some judgment of them, didn't you? Sounded like it. So this brings me, thanks for the segue, this brings me into conditions necessary for ill will and anger to arise. So, what happens basically is our ideas of how things should be get violated. It's that simple. And it can be a wholesome idea you have, like children should not be slapped. You know, when you see a child slapped by a mother in a grocery store, you immediately feel anger rise. And it's a very wholesome idea, the idea that children should not be slapped. Or it could be a less wholesome idea, like, my idea is such and such, and other people don't agree with me, and I'm angry with them. So that's less wholesome. But regardless of whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, your idea of how things should be was violated, and anger arose. Or it can happen, as you said, over a long period of time. Your idea of everyone should, or at least you personally should be entitled to a house. I can't meet for the other people without knowing you.
Okay.
Everyone should be able to buy a house. Your belief is violated. And so it's violated over and over again over a period of time. And so it isn't a flash of anger in a grocery store. It's starting to harden a little bit. A long-term resentment. So, it depends now. I need to describe from the Buddhist point of view how opinions come to be. So, here you are, or here I am, I, Darlene, this flesh that has to be protected and taken care of, this body of Darlene, and I have certain self-interested ideas of what's good for Darlene. Like Darlene should be driven here, and people should be quiet while Darlene talks and things like that. So I have certain ideas about what should happen to Darlene. And whenever this is violated, my anger arises. So, this is, very simplistic. It's basically what happens. Now, if my point of view is a little beyond Darlene, and it starts to be Darlene and Philippa. Darlene, Trish, Philippa, Trish, Yvonne, and Darlene. Then it's already a little broader point of view, and it's the four of us against the rest of you now. But what I think now is, what I'm interested in is a little broader, because it has to include the three of them. Maybe Yvonne doesn't mind if somebody talks well, starting if somebody makes noise. So I have to expand a little bit to include these three people. So my idea of what is right and wrong gets broader. So where you bring the sword down and say this is right and this is wrong depends on your self-interest. So if you, now it may be that your point of view could get narrower even from including a group. Like let's say you're a group of, I don't know, a group of a group of no. A group of Soto Zen people. A group of Soto Zen people, and we don't like Vipassana people. So then we all reinforce each other, and the sword comes down, and Soto Zen is good, Vipassana is bad. But let's say as a group, we Vipassana and Zen people are on the street, and here comes down the street toward us a bunch of Tibetan Buddhists. And suddenly we, the Vipassana and Zen people are all together against the Tibetans. And then, you know, we, so the sword comes down here with, you know, Theravada, blah, blah, blah over here, Vajrayana over here. Then we're all a group walking down the street and Christians come toward us. You know, so you get my point. Wherever you draw the sword, you put the sword down and say, this is good, this is bad, has everything to do with your particular point of view, self-interested point of view, in a particular situation. So this should lead already to a bunch of ideas about how you might deal with it. Just the fact that this is how we decide what makes us angry in any particular situation. Did it suggest anything to you that you might practice with?
Mm-hmm.
Yes? I'll take that as a volunteer. The whole, to include the whole world or the lot of sentient beings for that? Pretty wide, might be a little impossible. Any other ideas of how to work on this? And what would have to happen for you to be open? You'd have to give up a little sense of your, what is self-interested, a narrow idea of what is self-interested. Yeah, for that topic. So the antidote from the Abhidharmic point of view, the Abhidharma proposes a couple of antidotes. Now, remember the Abhidharma, old Buddhism wants to get rid of anger. And I went into it in detail last time I came, how from the Abhidharmic point of view, emotions are basically have to be brought into balance. That emotions are always some difficulty. Emotions out of control take the rest of the personality with it. So the old, very old, metaphor for this is the two guys dragging a third guy and throwing them into a fire pit. So that's a part of yourself being dragged by another part of yourself and thrown into a fire pit. All of you have to suffer because one part of you dragged you into the fire pit. And this is the emotional part. So in the Abhidharmic system, emotions have to be brought under control, brought into balance. This is not so different from the middle way. It's just a different point of view. So emotions have to be brought into balance by meditation. They have to be uprooted. You can't just suppress them, as I said last time, because then the energy ruins the system. The energy of a suppressed emotion, you know, it's like a virus in a computer. You know, it may be look okay on the surface, but underneath all the files, and maybe I shouldn't use this analogy. So the Abhidharma actually has antidotes for this, and one of them is very straightforward, the four Brahma Viharas. One, loving kindness, two, compassion, three, sympathetic joy, and four, equanimity. So you actually take these practices as they're laid out, and you practice them one at a time. You practice sending loving kindness first to yourself, and after you've done that for a while, you practice sending them to all the people you love, and after you practice that for a while so that you really feel like you're moving this energy through you, then the next group you practice with is people you just know, like your coworkers or your next door neighbors or somebody like that that you don't love, but you just know people. Then after that it's people you don't know, and then after that it's, you know, rocks and trees and things like that, sentient beings, and then after that it's people you hate. So you gradually, you know, these are specific practices that you take up and do to move this hateful energy through you. So you can imagine that if you're a person with a stance of ill will, it's pretty hard to get yourself to do a practice like that. But that's first. Loving kindness is seen as the easiest of the four brahmaviharas. And then there's compassion, which is not sympathy, by the way, but actually identifying your well-being with other people's well-being. And then sympathetic joy is a counter to envy and jealousy. You know, when someone gets a promotion at work and you didn't, it's very hard to feel good for them. And so you specifically practice it. You specifically say to yourself and make the outward behavior of, oh, how wonderful for you. Oh, how, and you do whatever makes you feel that. You know, offer them, take them out for lunch, you know, just so that you're replacing that envy and bitterness that's eating you up inside. You're moving it. You're actually moving it through. There's a lot of wisdom to be said. And then finally, equanimity, in this context doesn't just mean that you're very calm. It means that you identify with everything in the world. You know, the context where your reference is huge. So your equanimity is because you love everything that exists. And of course you're very calm if you love everything that exists. What could possibly disturb you? So those are the practices, specific practices to deal with loving kindness. I mean, to deal with ill will. So that from the Abhidharmic point of view, anger muddies the water of the mind, and meditation settles it. It's like pond water. Anger, or any emotion, you know, messes it up so all the dirt rises up and all that. But if you meditate, then all that dirt and mud settles back down to the bottom again. And this is how we get the discriminative judgment, which is all the dirt has settled to the bottom, and that very capacity that made ill will such a bad thing, in other words, as Brian mentioned, the separation between I and thou, the separation, always separation, or Philippa said, higher up, I separate the two of us so I can be higher up. All that separation that was being done is now complete. You separate, but this time you separate on the basis of seeing clearly, not self-interest. Your scope, or your ground of being, is so large now, after practicing these practices, that you are able to do the same thing you did before, separate things out, but this time, you see them as they are. And so, this is actually a good trait. A good trait, because when you differentiate between things as they truly are, not from the point of self-interest, then you can help other people who separate things out. You can become a teacher, or a mathematician, or a professor, or a logician, or any kind of very smart person. Because that's what smart people do, is they discriminate between things. They put these things in categories, as opposed to these things. So if you're doing that from a scientific point of view, that's more what I'm talking about than from an interested point of view. Of course, that gets murky when there are grants involved. I don't know how many scientists we have here, but I used to work in a school. So So anyway, you get my point. So another point of view from the Abhidharmic point of view is to practice patience. Patience is the antidote to anger. There are six paramitas, six perfections that bodhisattvas practice. One is dana, generosity. These, by the way, are things that you might, if you were practicing closely with a teacher, you might explore each one of them. They're all gates to liberation. Is to perfect yourself in each of these six categories. One is generosity. One is ethics, the precepts. One is patience, which we're going to take up because it's the antidote to anger. One is energy or perseverance, being able to continue your practice over time. One is meditation, being able to produce samadhi. And one is understanding, wisdom. Well, all the five together combine to make wisdom. You then have the point of view that is wise, which is, namely, that you're able to see things rise and pass away. See things rise and pass away. So that's the view of wisdom. So from the point of view of practicing patience, well, you have no idea. This is laid out in Shantideva in the 8th century, and he goes into it quite thoroughly. So when you practice patience, you see all your enemies as spiritual friends. And the reason you do that is because your friends will never challenge you the way that enemies do. Your friends will never point out in the way that enemies do, and not directly, but anytime you have an enemy, and if you're a practitioner, you look at yourself. Well, what makes this person my enemy? What is my point of view? What that makes you, when you have an enemy, that makes you ask all kinds of questions about your stance to make another sentient being your enemy. And a friend won't do that for you. A friend won't do that for you. I was pretty old the first time I had a person, knew a person I really wanted to kill. And I feel that I was fortunate in one way that I never hated anybody that much, but this person made me understand why hitmen are available. She caused me so many problems that I thought if she would just die, that would be the perfect choice. And I thought, well, she's pretty young, a lot younger than I, so she's not going to die real soon. I have to hire a hit person. I never understood that before, and this time but because she was closely related to me, I actually had to figure, I had to deal with it. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, she just passes out of my life. She stayed in my life and is in my life to this day. So I had to deal with her. And it taught me so much. I can't tell you how much it was, my point of view. I mean, she really was, as a friend of mine pointed out at the time, my spiritual friend. She really was. So you see your enemies as spiritual friends, and also you challenge the notion of self. That whole thing of bringing down the sword, this is good for Darlene, this is bad for Darlene. You start fooling around with where the sword can come down. Where can it come down? Because it's all fluid. It gets very fluid if you practice patience. So you start thinking of where, what are the possible ways? And that's just what I did with this woman. I knew what my self-interest was, but I thought, well, maybe if I move the sword over here and give her the benefit of this doubt, maybe that would explain her bizarre behavior. So the ability to fool around with your concept of self-interest enough that you can start moving the sword around. Does everyone understand what I mean by the sword of self-interest? Yes,
Darlene, you say practice patience, though. I guess my wondering is there any way that you can practice patience actually change
your
behavior?
All of the above. But you start with your mind, of course. I mean, just to see your enemy is a spiritual friend is a pretty big need for most people. And then to start, once you see them as your friend, you know, your teacher, then you can start, so far I'm just talking about the mind, then you start fooling around with what your self-interest is. Could it shift or move or get bigger? And then you recognize, and this is how mindfulness is really important in this, you recognize your karma with regard to this. Like Jim said at the beginning of this meeting, he said, I recognize my karma. It is very helpful to recognize how you've been conditioned for how many generations, even just one, how you've been conditioned to behave in this realm the way that you do. So you have to say, what would it take for me to be patient in this situation? What would it take, given my karma, given that I'm, you know, very explosive, given that I tend to stuff my anger and then be passive aggressive later? You should be familiar with these patterns about yourself, and mindfulness really helps. For me, I couldn't even recognize my anger the first couple of years that I practiced with this koan, how to do to get angry. Because I'd stuffed it for so long that I didn't recognize it when it was there. I had to keep looking at behaviors and had to keep soliciting feedback from people. Do I look angry to you? Do I? Well, yes, you could. I said that, oh my God. So to try to locate it, to locate your karma and have a very clear idea of what your karma is with regard to this. What is your condition in system? And then constantly turning the situation as it progresses into a sense of gratitude. I'm grateful for the situation, right? Because it really gives me a chance to practice with this. I'm grateful for this. And then finally, and this, boy, did I have to practice this with this woman I'm talking about. Recognizing that every time you have a situation like this, an enemy, here you thought you were so holy, and an enemy, somebody you regard as a terrible person, arises. And so this is a great antidote to arrogance and self-congratulation. You think your practice is good, and then you have an enemy, you better run that by yourself again. This is a very good antidote to inflation. You look around and you say, oh, everybody loves me, you know, I gave this to charity last week, and I did this favor for my friend and all my relatives, and then pop, somebody comes up and doesn't like you and says you did a terrible thing to them, which you can hardly remember. Well, it's time to go back to the drawing board. We need this, or we'll be allowed to be complacent. At the very least, don't even have to be inflated. Just be complacent. Oh, I'm doing fine. I sit every day. So you can use these situations to challenge this. Because if you think that you're fine because you sit every day, your practice will lose its energy over time until it doesn't have any energy in it anymore. And you'll find yourself being interested in something else. And it wasn't that practice wasn't up to challenging you and interesting you, it's that you didn't inject any energy to it. You didn't make it relevant to your difficult situations in your life. There's practice over here, and then there's real life that I've got to deal with. So the more you can blend the two and see difficult situations as inspiring to your practice, the better. The more energetic. Someone told me today that they were able to see their illness as pointing them in a certain direction, a certain depth of practice. And that's just what I'm talking about. Taking difficult situations and making them the seat of, making them your koan at the very least. How did I get sick? Why am I sick? What will I do even better? What will I do with my illness? How can I live in the world with it and still love my life? That's a great poem. That's a great point. How can I still love my life even though my body is going to go? That'll stretch you a little bit. So are there any comments or questions at this point? Yeah. Well, I think that lots of things build character. Lots of things help you learn. I think tremendous pleasure is another way that you learn. If you just have a life of pain, then I think you become a bitter person. And I think then it's harder to learn things. So I think lots of things do, but certainly, I think you're right to suspect there have to, because you might say adversity and phenomenal good luck build character. Or pain and pleasure build character. So, I think that, whatever you've got actually is what is all you can use to build character. If you only have pain, then that's when just pain builds character. Whatever you've got there, raw materials, is what you're going to build character with if you're determined to build character. Now, if you came to me, I might ask you to refine your consciousness a little and begin to be able to pick out the pleasure that's right under your nose instead of just always automatically going to, maybe just pain gets your attention. Mm-hmm. There are lots of people like that. Just pain gets their attention, otherwise they don't notice anything. So that's a case in which such a person might refine their consciousness a little bit and begin to notice when pain ceases a little. Often, I work with people in pain, and often the first question I'll say, well, do you ever have relief at all? I mean, I just want to know what I'm dealing with here. And they, no, never. And then they'll start telling me a story. They'll forget that they said that, and they'll start telling me something in which they had great pleasure in some simple thing. Meeting a friend, or a friend came to visit. Oh, I thought you had pain all the time. Oh, well, sometimes I don't. So it took somebody else to point out that the pain does have gaps in it. But as a practitioner, those gaps are gold, because it shows you what you're capable of if you aren't always focused on pain. And you can say, oh, I'll just shift my focus a little bit. As I said last time, I do believe that the basic to the art of living is the ability to focus at will, the ability to focus at. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
How do you deal with the focus? It's like the pleasure thing, like no kids come out and happen when you leave. And every time you're in a meal, it's happening when you leave.
Say that again. Every pleasure.
It's like for the pressure and the pain of the situation. Mm-hmm. The pleasure is like a little kid come out and happen when you leave, and now you don't see that one. When you go to pay attention to it, and you're back.
So you're saying that pleasure might start to come into your life,
right. But
as soon as you actually clear your mind enough to focus, then you notice tremendous pain. So how have you dealt with it thus far? Not noticed it. Has that been successful? So try something else. You know, when you have an extraordinary amount of pain, if you can get together any energy at all besides the energy required to just bear it, if you can get together any energy at all, then try to experiment. In this case, just giving yourself up to your pain and saying, okay, what do you want me to do now? It might just be lie down for a long time, but at some point, it might be something else too, and then that's your chance to move. So not knowing what I might suggest. I do think that, the burying pain, which is a natural action pain, closes the door on, dealing with it. And for a period of time, we might have to do that actually. I'm not saying that's a bad approach. It's certainly one you should try, because if it's successful, then you don't have to bear the amount of pain you have to bear when you come into consciousness about it. But something else happens when you come into consciousness with your pain. Some other thing that you didn't know was going to happen. And you can't tell ahead of time. If you're looking at it from the outside, you can't tell ahead of time what's going to happen. Like people go to a session, a 7-day sitting, and, you know, they've heard, and they can figure out for themselves, oh, this is going to be terrible sitting in one position for 7 days. This is going to hurt big time. And as a matter of fact, it does. But there's something else that happens too that makes it bearable. Being a player as opposed to a bystander brings a tremendous amount of power. I saw another thing over here. Yeah. Well, if you're turning toward the good things and handling them, just get irritated. Not so bad. I mean, you have to protect other people. I mean, you can't be screaming at kids and stuff like that, but, yeah. And also, I think there are certain professions that lend themselves to receiving and venting, like meter maids and airplane personnel and people like that. Well, if you have to, you have to. So, anyway, I wouldn't worry about that unless you lose energy from it.
I think that is I don't exactly know how to figure out where it's coming from. I'm ready to have a lot of problems. I don't know whether I've sort of transformed the hot anger that I used to have. I used to, you know, landlord and break chairs. Mm-hmm. And,
that's what I'm suggesting.
You know, about the house. And then, you know, but then now, oh my God, I just didn't know what you were thinking. I have to pick up all dressed for the first time today. And you know, why did they have to go to the house again? You know, I mean, just little things that imitate you. But yes, I don't know whether sometimes we're going to transform that energy sort of into the hot energy and sort of whether it's just manifesting in a different way. But I mean, I do come from a karmic history of hot energy people and hot anger.
Well, this brings us to the middle way, practicing anger in the middle way, which is that you take complete responsibility. If you want dogs shit where you don't want them to shit. So, it's very helpful if you say, I have made this decision, I want dogs. So every time you see shit, oh, there's evidence of the fact I want dogs.